amazing how rarely the Buddha talks about being in the present moment, given that so much of the meditation is focused here. When he talks about how important it is to be here, it's always with a reflection that there's work to be done here, and you don't know how much time you have. So we focus on the breath, we focus on our mind in the present moment. Because this is the starting point of so much of our suffering. We won't understand why, what's causing us to act in ways in the present moment that are causing suffering now and on into the future. Because it's our intentions that shape our life. Where do our intentions happen? They happen right here, right now. And all too often they're relegated down to the middle-level bureaucracy in the mind. It's as if you were the chairman of your company and you think you're in charge. But it turns out that a lot of your underlings are making decisions without your knowing it. So you want to dig down in the present moment and see what's going on here. What are the decisions that are being made? Because as the Buddha said, we shape our experience out of the raw material that comes from our past karma. But it's the skill with which we shape it makes all the difference. It's because we have a lack of skill. That's one of the meanings of avijja, or ignorance. That the things we do for the sake of happiness end up causing pain. It's bad enough when you're here relatively healthy. Things get worse as you get older. Aging comes, it comes right here. When death comes, it comes right here. And what will you have to deal with these things when they come? Several years back, I was at a funeral in Bangkok. It was for a monk I had known and really respected and had a lot of affection for. I called him Lung Lung, which means venerable uncle. And his funeral was an amazingly happy affair, partly because a lot of us hadn't seen one another. People came to the funeral, especially John Fuang students. In some cases, it had been 20 years since we'd seen one another. So there was a lot of socializing going on. On top of that, Lung Lung had touched the lives of a lot of people. On the day of his cremation, thousands of people showed up. But then the next day they had what was called the gathering of the ashes. Which whatever bones were remaining from his cremation were gathered together, and some of them were placed in a little niche in the jetty there at Bamakut, and the rest were going to be taken out and placed in the ocean. The Navy has its academy right there at the mouth of the Chao Phraya River, and one of the services they perform is to have a boat there for people who want to take ashes out and scatter them in the ocean. Although you don't really scatter them, you have to put them in a container which is sealed. Because the fishermen at the mouth of the river don't like the idea that either they're going to catch bones in their nets or that the fish that they're catching have been feeding on people's bones. So the container has to be sealed as it goes out. It happened to be very overcast day. We had to skirt around Bangkok because that was the middle of the demonstrations in 2010. We got out there in the ocean, right at the mouth of the river, and you looked around and it was a gray day and it was a gray ocean. The ocean was still, featureless. The sky was gray and featureless. In fact, everything was so gray it was hard to tell where the horizon was. The sky and the ocean just seemed to blend into one another. And so we did the ceremony, placed the container down in the ocean, scattered some flowers, and then the boat did a final turn as kind of a salute. We looked back, and there it was, just this big gray expanse and just a few little flowers floating in the ocean. You knew they were going to sink pretty soon. And there weren't that many of us. The thousands that had been there the day before had all gone. There were about 10 or 15 of us. And a lot of the women began to cry. It seemed so lonely. And of course, when you cry over a loss like that, it's a lot of it is you're crying for yourself because you realize each of us someday is going to be there, that lonely spot, gray, featureless. And what do we have as our friend there? The problem is when you're lonely, you tend to grab onto your cravings. Take them as your friends. But again, our cravings come from ignorance, and if we follow them, they lead to a lot of suffering. So you need skills in order to recognize, okay, these are cravings and not necessarily your friends. You can't depend on them. You've got to have something else beside your cravings as your companions at a time like that. That's where the skills of meditation come in. You need mindfulness. You need alertness. You need ardency. You need concentration. You need discernment, particularly mindfulness and discernment. They put these two concepts together a lot in Thailand. There's a Thai phrase, sati panya. When you take the compound apart, it means mindfulness, discernment. You put it together, it also means intelligence. It's the opposite of ignorance. Or at least it's these are the qualities that can do away with ignorance. That's what we're trying to develop as we meditate. So how do we get this mindfulness and discernment? As John Lee points out, discernment is a matter of skill. And it comes from learning how to do something skillfully. It's not something you just pick up from reading books and getting the concepts. The wisdom comes in seeing, okay, these concepts are useful as tools for getting rid of our ignorance, getting to know the mind really, really well. So it doesn't fall for its old cravings. The analogy he gives is of learning any physical skill, like making clay tiles, making baskets. You get instructions, you put them into practice. But then it's pretty common that the first time you put things together, it's not quite the way it looks when the teacher does it. So either you can give up, get discouraged, or else you can say, well, the teacher's a human being, I'm a human being. If the teacher can do it, so can I. So you look at what you've done, and then you compare it to the standard that's set by the teacher. And you see what's wrong. And then you go back and you look very carefully at how you might change what you did. And then you look very carefully at yourself while you're doing, say, making the new tiles. And get more and more clear about what are you doing and what the results are. And you can see the connection with, say, where there was a moment of a lapse in mindfulness or something that wasn't quite regular, as when you're weaving something or when you're running a sewing machine. Putting the cloth in, how do you put it in evenly? How do you make sure you don't rush things, bunch things up? How do you make sure that the seam that you're making is straight? And you realize you have to be very careful about looking at the results and looking at what you're doing at the same time. And learn how to make adjustments. This requires two other qualities that John Lee connected with discernment. One is in the context of concentration practice. And the other is in the context of mindfulness. And of course, he doesn't draw a clear line between the two practices. Mindfulness and concentration go together. In terms of concentration, it's evaluation. In terms of mindfulness, it's ardency. Ardency is the putting of your whole heart into what you're doing. You want to do it really well. One of the reasons we think about death as a motivation for meditation is that you realize you're going to need some really strong skills then. It's at that point where the body is going to be the least help because the body's going to be leaving you and it's probably going to not leave you just smoothly and quietly. It's not going to slip out with little cat's feet. Like the fog. The there's going to be a lot of turmoil. There's going to be pain, and different parts of the body that used to function well are just going to start falling apart. And we get little foretastes of this as we age. Things don't go well for a while, then they go back to regularity, and then they slip off and do something else again, and then they come back. And the slipping off gets more and more often, and the coming back gets less and less strong. And finally, the whole thing just falls apart. Someone once compared it to a house on fire. When the house is on fire, none of the rooms in the house are safe. And in the midst of that, you've got to be cool and calm. So one of the things we learn to do as we stay here in the present moment is learn how to deal with pain. You want to be ardent in figuring out why is it that pain in the body has an impact on the mind. If you learn how to see that as something strange, then you've got something, then you've got a handle on the problem. All too often our reaction is, well, of course, if there's a pain in the body, it's going to pain the mind, because the body and the mind are connected, and this is our body. But if you can see the idea that, okay, the fact that there's pain there in the body does not have to create problems for the mind. And the fact that it does is something strange. And try to figure out what happens. That attitude of seeing it as strange, stepping back from it and seeing it as something separate and a little bit alien, that's going to help you a lot. In addition to ardency, in the context of concentration, the discernment factor is evaluation. You look at what you're doing and you figure out, is it going well? And if it's not going well, what can I do to make it better? And as you can see, the ardency and the evaluation connect very directly to that image of learning a skill. You want to do it well, and then you have to evaluate what you're doing to see if it really is as good as you'd like it to be. And when you've mastered what you've learned from the teacher, you say, okay, well, is there anything more that I can do with this? And this is how skills get developed. In what direction do you want to develop your skill as a maker of tiles, or as a basket weaver, or as a tailor? It's through ardency and evaluation. These can become your friends. The ardency is the quality of the will that goes into this, and the evaluation is the quality of the observer. William James once talked about two kinds of truth. There's the quality, the truth of the will, and the truth of the observer. The truth of the observer is the one that, where you can't let your will get in the way. You're studying stars, you can't make the data, you can't cook the data, because then it's useless. You can't say, well, I'd like it to be like this, I'd like it to be like that. You just have to look at what's there. With truths of the will, though, things like wanting to develop a skill. The skill won't happen unless you want it. In this case, the will has to be there. But for it to be a genuine skill, you have to have both this ability to be ardent and to evaluate very carefully. In other words, be honest with yourself when things are not going well. But at the same time, not so down on yourself that you think that the honest thing is always to say that things aren't any good or you're not any good. That kind of honesty is not really helpful. You have to learn a balance in your evaluation. That you see what you've done, it's not quite right yet, the concentration isn't what you want yet. But at the same time, you have to keep up your ardency that you want to do it well regardless. So a lot of the skill in developing skills is learning to keep these two qualities in balance, your will and your powers of observation, your ardency and your powers of evaluation. When you learn how to master these, okay, then when the time comes when the body, your breath, your friends here are leaving you, you don't latch on to craving as your friend. You latch on to your mindfulness and discernment as your friends. When there's a sense of kind of lonely, blank grayness, you realize you're not alone. You've got something you can really depend on. So you have the opportunity to develop these qualities now and make the most of it.